Now
on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler, Jeff Wolf behind the console, Jane Houghton, our producer this morning, as the prices continue to go up. Oh, boy. Show today, we got a lot to cover. Of course, we'll be joined by KT McFarland. We will have Tony Schaefer join us, also John Gizzi, our White House correspondent, of course. Cheryl Atkinson will be with us. Jennifer Harper, who writes Inside the Beltway for the Washington Times. Jim Trusty, give us the latest on the Trump Mar-a-Lago documents investigation. Also on the way this morning, we'll talk to Giuseppe Niosi. He is a candidate for D.C. Council at Large, a third-generation Washingtonian. Interesting guy, and we'll talk to him in this hour. So we got a lot to cover here on the Saturday Morning Update. And what we like to do is we kind of like to cut through some of the spin, some of the propaganda that is coming out of the administration. And as an example, they would have you feel the economy's great, and we're all going to be happy campers. And unfortunately, that's not quite the case. Wholesale prices up 8.5% over a year ago in September. That's up 0.4% from last month. So the prices are going up. The consumer price index now 8.2% up from a year ago. Core inflation up 6.6% from a year ago. But they wouldn't have you think that. Now, the president sat down with Jake Tapper earlier in the week. It was the kickoff for Jake's new show, and it didn't seem to go too well, according to the media writers. Here's what the president had to say about whether we're in a recession or not.
It hadn't happened yet. It hadn't. There's no guarantee that there's going to be a recession. I don't think there will be a recession. If it is, it'll be a very slight recession.
Well, technically, if you look at the dictionary, we're already in a recession. But, of course, he defines it differently, and I don't know what a slight recession feels like. I think a recession feels pretty bad. If you get a recession, I'm not so sure they're so slight. But, of course, he's got an election of his Democratic colleagues coming up within a month, so he's got to do the habita, habita, habita right now. Along these lines, now, it's funny, they talk about how Republicans always try and put fear into the American people. Republicans scaring you on crime. Well, here's the president scaring the American people about how Republicans are going to put inflation even higher than he has.
When it actually comes time to do something about inflation around the kitchen table, Republicans in Congress are saying no. If Republicans take control, the prices are going to go up, as will inflation.
I'm sorry. That's just a joke. It's just a joke. So how does Rick Scott feel about that, the senator from Florida?
He's in la-la land. I mean, this is the guy that has no idea what's actually happened in the real world. He's never been a poor kid worried about how do you put food on the table. He doesn't have any idea what people are dealing with.
So that's Rick Scott, of course. Now, Stephen Moore, you see him quite often, a pundit. He's an economics guy, former economic advisor to President Trump. He summed it up in 6 seconds.
Biden came in and spent and borrowed and printed $4.1 trillion. I mean, this isn't complicated, folks.
Stephen Moore, and that's kind of a look at some of the economic issues. Now, it's kind of funny that the White House chief of staff came out this week and was bragging about how the cost of living for Social Security was going to be going up 8.7%. The only reason it has to go up 8.7% is because you sent the prices up 8.7%. I don't know, I'd be being braggadocious about the idea of you have to pay out a cost of living increase, a COLA, of 8.7%. The way they spin things, and I hope people are seeing through it. I'm not convinced that people are seeing through it, but I think maybe they are. Now, something you may not have heard about, depending on what media outlets you listen to or don't listen to. There was a story earlier in the year. You may have seen the pictures of the Border Patrol agents, and they were accused of whipping migrants. And we have a clip here from President Biden about whipping the migrants. And I'm sure you saw this, a lot of it, because it got a lot of attention, especially when the president amped it up. And here's what he had to say.
to see people treated like they did, horses barely running them over, people being strapped, it's outrageous. I promise you, those people will pay.
Well, hopefully, maybe those people will sue because they didn't do it and they were exonerated from it. And as it turns out, there was a Freedom of Information Act request, and the results showed an email from one of the communications people in Alejandro Mayorkas' office 2.5 hours before Mayorkas went out the same day and made some comments. And in the email, it explained that there was a reporter interviewed one of the photographers, and the photographer said, this is not what it appears to be. It is not a whipping, and basically said, it's not what they're saying it is. But Mayorkas' communication person had that to Mayorkas 2.5 hours before he went out on the podium. And one of the pundits this week I was listening to said, if you are the Secretary of Homeland Security or any cabinet secretary, and you're going to go out and make a speech or a presser for the public and for the media, that you will definitely read any email that comes from your communications department before you go out. So he had 2.5 hours to read this before he went out. But in spite of what the photographer said, Mayorkas just stayed with the company line from the White House.
We know that those images painfully conjured up the worst elements of our nation's ongoing battle against systemic racism.
Okay, so we're playing the racism card there from Mayorkas, even though he knew that the photographer said, that's not what it looks like. Well, Kamala Harris joined in.
It also evoked images of some of the worst moments of our history, where that kind of behavior has been used against the indigenous people of our country, has been used against African Americans during times of slavery.
And, of course, Maxine Waters made some headlines at the same time as well.
What the hell are we doing here? What we witness takes us back hundreds of years. What we witnessed was worse than what we witnessed in slavery. Cowboys with their reins again whipping black people.
Now, you do remember that there was an investigation, and the investigation found that those Border Patrol agents on horseback did not do that. Okay. It is 6:16. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
On 270 northbound near Montrose Road, there's a disabled vehicle reported along the right side, so stay to your left and use caution there. Watch for delays also on the outer loop between the Clara Barton Parkway and the GW Parkway. Work zone on the outer loop near the Legion Bridge is reported. And in Prince George's County, 210 is still closed in both directions between Berry Road and Livingston Road due to a serious accident there. Also, some street closures in effect today for the Race for Every Child. That includes 10th Street. That is closed between Constitution Avenue and E Street. And 11th Street is closed between E Street and Pennsylvania Avenue. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
After a cool and clear start to the day, it'll be mostly to partly sunny and mild with highs in the low to mid 70s, clear and cool tonight, low to mid 50s in the cities, mid 40s in the suburbs. Increasing cloudiness for your Sunday with light rain arriving towards evening, highs will be in the low 70s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Matt Ritter in the First Alert Weather Center.
6:17 on the Saturday morning update in the nation's capital, 47 degrees.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
Saturday morning update continues, and we have some audio that you probably didn't catch on the network newscasts, because I tend to doubt that ABC, CBS, or NBC would have devoted 47 seconds to this video and audio from Tulsi Gabbard as she renounced her membership in the Democratic Party. This is Tulsi Gabbard.
I can no longer remain in today's Democratic Party. It's now under the complete control of an elitist cabal of warmongers driven by cowardly wokeness, who divide us by racializing every issue and stoking anti-white racism, who actively work to undermine our God-given freedoms enshrined in our Constitution, and who are hostile to people of faith and spirituality, who demonize the police, who protect criminals at the expense of law-abiding Americans, who believe in open borders, who weaponize the national security state to go after their political opponents, and above all, are dragging us ever closer to nuclear war. Now, these are some of the main reasons I'm leaving the Democratic Party.
Some of the main reasons? It's a pretty good list. Tulsi Gabbard, no friend of the Democrats. Remember when Hillary Clinton called her a Russian asset? That was classic. So anyway, that's some interesting news. And again, you probably wouldn't have caught that on the mainstream. I doubt they would run that one. As we continue, some controversy around the Pennsylvania Senate race. Of course, John Fetterman, the lieutenant governor, the Democrat, health issues. And it was interesting, an NBC reporter in Pittsburgh sat down with John Fetterman. And she made some comments after the interview, and she said basically that, you know, when they sat down for the pre-interview, that he had a little trouble understanding them. So here's what she had to say.
We did find that in small talk before the interview, without captioning, it seemed it was difficult for Fetterman to understand our conversation. Myself, my producer, and our crew did find that small talk before that captioning was difficult.
So she's a veteran reporter in Pittsburgh. She works for NBC, so she has some credibility. Well, everybody piled on her around the country and said, no, we've done interviews with him and he was fine, yada, yada, yada. The difference is that this was the first sit-down interview that had been done. The other people who had interviewed him apparently on Zoom or something of a video computer link, and he apparently had closed captioning for those interviews. So not to make fun of the guy, not to poke at the guy, you know, not to criticize him. It's the story here is that a reporter reports a fact, and she is criticized, and Twitter attacked her, and other reporters attacking her, and obviously Democrats attacking her. So, you know, you can't even report a story anymore without being criticized. So that wanted to mention that one in case you missed it. Here's an interesting headline out of New York. New York Governor Kathy Hochul slams Biden for failing to take ownership of the migrants heading north. Wow. I wonder if that Lee Zeldin campaign poll numbers are starting to scare Kathy Hochul a little bit there in New York. She really came out. You don't usually hear a Democrat attacking the president, especially a New York Democrat attacking the president for failing to take ownership of the migrant crisis. Here's another interesting headline. You all seen the Lincoln Project commercials, real nasty attack ads, typically on former President Trump or Republican candidates. Lincoln Project's Steve Schmidt blasts co-founders as unethical, suggests disgraced group should disband. Very interesting, coming from a guy who was with the Lincoln Project. Another interesting headline this week you may have missed. Senator Cory Booker said that there should be no super PACs for anyone, but now he's raising money for one. And these are all headlines that I get from either my Microsoft News feed or my Google News feed. So these are not like things we're making up out of a clear blue sky. These are on Google or Microsoft News. And as I mentioned earlier, the headline, another floundering turnout for CNN with Jake Tapper's primetime show debut. And that was the one that had President Biden on it. It is 6:22. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. And coming up next, a conversation with an interesting young candidate in Washington.
Be a part of the conversation and stay informed.
Follow WMALDC on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.
It is a Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler, and it is the campaign season with the November elections right around the corner. And there's a lot of door knocking going on around D.C., and I had a knock on my door. And it was a gentleman who is running for D.C. Council at large. He is a Republican. He has kind of an interesting story, and I thought it might be interesting to share with you this morning. Giuseppe Niosi is running for D.C. Council at large. And one of the things that struck me is we see a lot of younger people running in the Republican races around the country. Also, what struck me is that Giuseppe is a third-generation Washingtonian and an officer in the U.S. Navy Reserves. And all these things kind of added up, and I thought it would be interesting to talk to a third-generation Washingtonian running for D.C. Council at large in what is a very Democratic town. How do you really go out and talk to the voters, most of whom are going to be Democrats?
Frankly, knocking on doors in D.C., you're bound to knock on a plentiful amount of Democrat doors. And what I have found is, especially with local issues, we have a lot of commonality. We all want better public safety. We all want our children or adults to have continuous education or just better education. And we all want to have a robust local economy. I think that these issues that I'm running on have been resonating with Republican, Independent, and Democrat alike.
We don't see a lot of third-generation Washingtonians. And tell us how growing up in D.C. and, of course, your family, and how that shapes your views as you campaign for the city council.
There aren't many true blue Washingtonians, let alone three generations worth of Washingtonians. I had the opportunity to, you know, grow up in the northeast neighborhood of Brookland. My father made his impact to the community by owning and operating a small Italian deli. And that was my first look at sort of how a community can come together, at how a community can develop. And it really gave me kind of a good insight of, you know, how hard work, how just being nice to our neighbors, how, you know, community service is really kind of an impactful thing. And that's something that I think that Washington, D.C. has veered off course slightly. And so I think that D.C. does have a very uniqueness. It's kind of, you know, I don't want to take the phrase that it's a big little town, but we do have some very tight-knit communities. And I've had the absolute privilege when I was door knocking to really see how some of these communities are thriving, but also kind of learn their concerns. And again, you know, each community has a different nuance as to what issues impact them the most, whether it be economic development, crime, you know, education, you know, their school system. And so, you know, really learning through a grassroots effort, I think, sets me apart from some of my competitors in this race.
With all of the contention and discord in politics these days, what motivates you to want to get in the middle of all of that?
I really appreciate this question, and frankly, this is something that in a lot of ways has kept me up at night, because I personally believe that you need to be the change that you want to see. I wasn't going to sit around and wait for someone to represent this city in an adequate way where all voices were being represented. One of the biggest things that I personally had found when I was door knocking, and I've been door knocking, you know, really since we were allowed to back in February, is there's a lot of disenfranchisement in this city through all eight wards. So what that kind of tells me is, you know, a handful of people are feeling the love, and I wasn't going to sit around and wait for someone to represent this city in an adequate way where all voices were being represented. And that was something that really sort of helped motivate me to, again, you know, be the change I want to see, to have the integrity, to show up in these communities and, you know, try my hardest to help in any way I can.
Well, that is the essence of public service. Giuseppe Niosi, if people want to find out more about you, where do they go?
You can go to my website at niosi2022.com or niosi2022.com. And one thing I did want to add, and, you know, I find that this is actually a pretty telltale metric, is I'm the fourth Republican in Washington, D.C. history to have raised over six figures. And what that tells me is, again, the message is resonating with the voters. People are excited to hear it. People are excited to be a part of this campaign. Again, we're very grassroots efforts, and I continue to door knock, and I've continued to do everything that I can have in my power to, you know, push us over the victory line at November 8th.
Giuseppe Niosi, running for D.C. Council at Large. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Have a great one.
6:30 on the Saturday Morning Update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
And in the news, the Justice Department has asked a federal appeals court to overturn a judge's appointment of the independent arbiter to review documents seized during the FBI search of former President Trump's Florida estate at Mar-a-Lago. The appeal is the latest salvo in weeks of litigation over the scope of duties of the special master. Russian President Vladimir Putin expects he will have his troop mobilization for combat in Ukraine to end in about 2 weeks. That would allow him to end the unpopular and chaotic call-up meant to counter the Ukrainian battlefield gains and solidify his illegal annexation of the Ukrainian territory. Putin facing domestic discontent and military setbacks in a neighboring country that has been increasingly armed with advanced Western weapons. 6:34, Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
On the outer loop of the Beltway past University Boulevard, an accident now moved to the shoulder, but you will find a brief delay through the area. Still some slowing as well on the outer loop over the Legion Bridge. Looks like the work zone has cleared. There is an incident to watch out for at 270 northbound near Montrose Road. A disabled vehicle blocks the right lane, so watch out for a brief delay there. And southbound on 270 between Middlebrook Road and Watkins Mill Road, two left lanes are blocked with road work. Now from GarageRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
After a cool and clear start to the day, it'll be mostly to partly sunny and mild with highs in the low to mid 70s, clear and cool tonight, low to mid 50s in the cities, mid 40s in the suburbs. Increasing cloudiness for your Sunday with light rain arriving towards evening, highs will be in the low 70s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Matt Ritter in the First Alert Weather Center.
47 degrees at 6:35 on the Saturday morning update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It is the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jennifer Harper is with us each weekend. She writes inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. And a good morning to you.
And a good morning to you.
Well, the inflation, the gasoline prices keep going up. The Democrats are trying to tell us that they're going down. So what do you envision as the midterms are approaching?
Well, kind of across the board, there's the feeling that all of this bad news regarding your money and your cost of food and everything else is definitely going to be bad news for the Democratic Party as these midterm elections. I mean, they are fast materializing on the horizon there, Rick. Of course, everybody probably knows that Consumer Price Index was revealed earlier this week, 8.2% inflation compared to a year ago. And so I consulted a whole lot of people that were looking at this, and one particular columnist I think is really kind of nailed it would be Jim Garrity. He's with National Review, and he said there will be any last-minute bursts of good economic news to save Democrats' bacon in the midterm election. Then again, maybe I shouldn't use that metaphor because the cost of bacon, a pound of bacon, has increased from $5.58 to $7.37. He says, welcome to Inflation Day. Man, he writes, you need an electron microscope to spot any silver lining in these inflation numbers. And, you just can't get away from their numbers. And he says that the Biden economic advisors are now shifting into gaslighting overdrive to spin the mess that they helped create. And moving right along to the gas prices as well, that whole feeling of, oh, my gosh, look at the prices, is going to affect the Democratic Party in a negative way. And I'm citing here a brand-new Convention of States Action Trafalgar Group poll. A lot of words this early in the morning. But anyway, they find out that the majority of likely U.S. voters, 54%, say that rising gas prices will make them more likely to vote for Republicans at the midterm. They say these numbers shed light on President Biden's desperate attempt to hide from voters the impact of his administration's far-left energy prices. That's coming from Mark Meckler. He's president of the Convention of States, which conducted the poll. He said, from recklessly depleting our nation's strategic oil reserves to pressuring OPEC countries to postpone cuts in oil production through the November election, it's clear that they are playing politics with our pocketbooks. That is both bad politics and bad policy. So not so good right now for them.
Well, you know, so many pundits, so many analysts, so many different ideas. Some of them stand out to us, though, as maybe they've got something here. And you saw one this week that looked quite interesting.
Yes, it was very interesting. This is coming from Saul Anizis. He's the former chairman of the Michigan Republican Party, and he's now the president of 60 Plus Association. That's a conservative organization for folks over 60. Anyway, it's very interesting. But he made a telling list this week, Rick, of all the contributing factors, and the title of his list is called Why Democrats Are Losing. He says the narrative that the progressive left wing of the Democrat Party has gone too far to the left is starting to resonate across the country, meaning people are saying, wait a minute, what's going on here? And he says that being soft on crime and defunding the police are losing issues. Again, this is coming from Saul Anizis. He says, along with expensive weekly grocery bills and gas station fill-ups, and the approval of biological men playing in girls' sports and using their bathrooms. But he really zoomed into fourth gear, I guess, and he says, here's the rest of the losing issues for Democrats. He said, Democratic acceptance of open borders and illegal immigrants is also a losing issue, along with denying parents basic information about what's being taught in local schools, and the disastrous retreat and surrender in Afghanistan. He moves on to say that killing the domestic energy market and his jobs is a losing issue, along with banning free speech in assembly because you don't agree with it, forcing taxpayers to pay off some student loans, government spending allowing the U.S. national debt to surpass $31 trillion, and last but not least, allowing the, quote, progressive loony left of the Democrat Party to lead is a losing issue. Again, that's coming from Saul Anizis, currently president of 60 Plus Association.
President Biden, in a sit-down interview with Jake Tapper earlier this week, said the majority of Americans like what I'm doing. What do the polls tell us?
This is actually, believe it or not, this is a CNN poll, okay? I'm just going to give you the numbers. A lot of numbers are this early in the morning, but here we go. 68% of U.S. adults disapprove of the way President Biden is handling inflation. 63% disapprove of the way he's handling the economy. 63% disapprove of the way he's handling gun policy. 61% disapprove of the way he's handling immigration. 58% disapprove of his efforts to help the middle class. 58% think he's doing a poor job in keeping important campaign promises. 57% disapprove of the way he's handling foreign affairs. And 44% disapprove of the way he is handling the coronavirus pandemic. Again, this is a CNN poll of about 2,000 adults conducted September 3 through October 5. And it was released Wednesday. And our friend, Republican National Committee Chairwoman Rona McDaniel, this is what she had to say about what she calls President Biden's failure tour. Particularly when he stopped in California, she said Californians, like the rest of America, are sick of skyrocketing gas prices, out of control crime and inflation, wiping out wages as a result of Democratic failure. California Democrats will soon realize what a drag Biden's approval rating is for their party when Pelosi is stripped of her speaker's gavel for good. So, wow. Anyway, that's what's going on in that particular sector.
Well, we saw the inflation and consumer price index up again this week. So when the going gets tough, the president goes on vacation.
Oh, that's a great way to put it. Yes. In fact, I have some of the places he's been. And this is coming from Mark Noller. I bet a lot of people will remember him. He is a former CBS News White House correspondent, very straightforward and smart kind of guy. And he's always tallied the vacations that presidents take. And this is his most recent tally for President Biden. He says, this 88th weekend of his presidency finds Biden at home in Wilmington, Delaware. It brings his weekend scorecard to, this is since he's been president, 44 weekends in Delaware, 18 weekends in Camp David, 17 weekends in the White House, 7 foreign trips, 1 trip to Nantucket, 1 trip to Kiowa Island, and there's other people that are noticing this. And according to Republican National Committee spokesman Emma Vaughn, She says, if you're wondering about Democrats' midterm prospects, President Joe Biden, the leader of the Democrat Party, is on vacation 1 month from Election Day. Mr. Biden doesn't care to campaign for his own party, and families can expect him to care even less about addressing the recession, crime surge, and border crisis. So still, all the criticisms are flying. And, you know, one other thing, First Lady Jill Biden is really traveling a great deal. She has been in Washington and Seattle, Washington, Tacoma, Washington. She's also been in California in the past week. And Tennessee, Wisconsin, Georgia, Washington, California, those are the fundraisers that she has been to in the last 10 days. And she's also kind of a traveling first lady. According to her biography at whitehouse.gov, and you can go there and read this yourself, Mrs. Biden traveled to 35 states, 60 cities, and three other countries during her first year as First Lady. So there you are, the traveling Biden.
6:45 on the Saturday Morning Update. Jennifer Harper, thank you very much for being with us this morning. Jim Trustee coming up next, but first, Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
Slow-going traffic on westbound 66 between Fair Oaks, Route 50, and the Fairfax County Parkway. And also, watch out for the new traffic pattern westbound between Route 28 in Centerville and Route 29 in Gainesville due to the new express lanes now open. In Prince George's County on 210, both north and southbound between Berry Road and Livingston Road, all lanes still blocked due to the accident. Earlier disabled vehicle on 270 northbound between the spur and Montrose Road has now been moved to the shoulder. Just watch out for a brief delay there. And still a work zone southbound between Middlebrook Road and Watkins Mill Road along the left side. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
After a cool and clear start to the day, it'll be mostly to partly sunny and mild with highs in the low to mid 70s, clear and cool tonight, low to mid 50s in the cities, mid 40s in the suburbs. Increasing cloudiness for your Sunday with light rain arriving towards evening, highs will be in the low 70s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Matt Ritter in the First Alert Weather Center.
47 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:46, the Saturday Morning Update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It is a Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. We are joined by Jim Trustee. He is a member of the Trump legal team. He is a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. And he is the former chief of the Organized Crime and Gang Section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, thank you for making the time to be with us.
Sure thing. Good morning.
We've been very fortunate to have you bring us up to date and help us cut through a lot of the punditry and a lot of the news stories that are looking at it from one side in many of the media outlets. And, of course, the Mar-a-Lago and the Department of Justice and the documents. So, Jim, what are the developments this week as you saw them?
Well, a couple of things with higher courts, but actually very narrow issues. So after Judge Cannon granted our motion back in September to appoint a special master, there were a couple of other narrow conditions to that that became the subject of litigation in the 11th Circuit, which covers Florida. And initially what happened was the 11th Circuit basically said they're not touching the full appeal yet on the special master appointment, but that they did agree with DOJ that the special master shouldn't access any documents marked classified at this point, and that DOJ can keep investigating with those documents while the litigation continues in South Florida. So it's a kind of a procedural little small part of the puzzle. The 11th Circuit said that Judge Cannon should not have allowed the special master to look at the classified documents yet, and also that the Department of Justice can keep using those documents in whatever they're doing by way of investigation. We filed a motion with the Supreme Court to see if they'd have any chance of weighing in on that component, and they denied that this week, which was not a giant surprise and not a particularly devastating moment for us, actually. At the same time, yesterday, the Department of Justice filed its brief with the 11th Circuit that's on the merits of the appeal. In other words, not the stay of the ruling, but the actual traditional appeal about the appointment of a special master. So I know this is really kind of tangled procedural stuff, but it's not particularly critical at this juncture, and it probably won't get resolved until we're actually about done with the special master anyway. So a lot of appellate stuff to worry about for the lawyers, not exactly the sexiest stuff for your listeners. More practically, what's going on is we're looking at thousands of things that were seized from Mar-a-Lago. We're looking at newspaper clippings, at personal letters, thank you notes, books, photographs, a couple of thousand, or I think about 2,900 documents that were seized from the storage area and office at Mar-a-Lago. And it's really kind of fascinating on one level, but aggravating on another, in that we don't think any of this stuff should have been subjected to a search warrant. But what we're seeing suggests to us that it was a very overbroad search warrant, that instead of just looking for documents marked classified, they took pretty much anything they could, including books and personal photos and, as I said, newspaper clippings. So we're going through that. We'll have some fights with the other side about what stuff is privileged, what stuff isn't, and there'll be some more litigation on that to come in really November and December. And then this Tuesday coming up, we have a telephonic phone conference with Special Master Deary to kind of talk about process. Where are we on all these things? How much longer is it going to take? And what kind of litigation is on the horizon? So, again, lots of things going on behind the scenes and lots of prep, but the big fights are still to come.
If the Special Master was agreed upon by both parties, why is the Department of Justice seem to be challenging you every step of the way with the Special Master?
Well, they never stopped resisting the general notion of a special master. They did not want any form of oversight over what they had done at Mar-a-Lago or what they're still doing. We agreed on the person, but they didn't agree on the concept. And so they continue to fight it all the way through the 11th Circuit. They file motions left and right. They challenge the authority of Judge Cannon to do this. And with each fight, I think we become more reassured that it was exactly the right thing to introduce a little bit of judicial oversight, another set of eyes to the process, instead of just having DOJ continue to assure the court that, you know, stay out of our business, just trust us.
We all saw the horror in the Waukesha, Wisconsin Christmas parade when six people were killed, dozens others injured. Daryl Brooks,
who was driving that vehicle, on trial. What stands out to you about this case, Jim?
Well, I guess the first thing, that it doesn't get much coverage. I mean, it really is kind of a media blackout on a horrific event. I mean, Daryl Brooks, who had a lengthy criminal history, who should not have been out of jail in the first place, and who had previously attacked an ex-girlfriend with the same car, a red SUV that was used in the Christmas parade attack, he's been charged with 6 counts of first-degree murder, 70 other counts. He killed 6 people, injured more than 60 others. And so it is a national-level horrific crime that gets very little play, I think probably for political reasons. This is a state prosecution. Brooks is representing himself, and part of what he's doing in representing himself is claiming to be a sovereign citizen. And prosecutors around the country see this from time to time. It's kind of a ridiculous concept that occasionally gets raised by people that claim the court has no jurisdiction over them, that they have their own sovereignty, they don't respect the court system. It doesn't particularly go well. You see it in a lot of like tax protester cases around the country, but it's kind of a ludicrous defense. It's not really a defense, just a ludicrous antic, I suppose, during the trial. The spectacle of him representing himself, Rick, is just something that I think stands out to me a lot. I mean, you know, keep in mind, that means he's literally cross-examining people that he injured. He's cross-examining people who tried to stop him, police officers that tried to stop him. And you remember there's a group called the Dancing Grannies, which were a number of elderly women that do all sorts of charitable things for the community that essentially attend the parade almost as cheerleaders. And he was cross-examining one of the surviving Dancing Grannies about, you know, how she couldn't identify him as the driver, which is not going to go very far in the grand scheme of things. And she basically looked at him and kind of crossly retorted, "I don't have eyes in the back of my head." And every time he cross-examines people in the third person, you know, "Did you see Mr. Brooks?" they tend to answer, "Yeah, I saw you." So there's a very strange dynamic, and a difficult dynamic for the judge and for the prosecutor when a defendant like this represents themselves, because they're constantly having to deal with somebody who really doesn't respect the rules of evidence, the rules of procedure. And again, it's almost comical, but then you step back and you realize, you know, 3 of the Dancing Grannies were mowed down and killed. A husband of one of them was killed. An 8-year-old boy named Jackson Sparks lost his life that day due to this hateful, monstrous person. He's been kicked out of the courtroom already. When he got kicked out of the courtroom, he was on closed-circuit TV, and he immediately took his shirt off. So he's doing all sorts of kind of ridiculous antics. And I guess the last thing I would say, I mean, the trial is about 10 days old. It's moving at a fairly brisk pace despite his obstruction. You know, I think they'll get there, and I think he'll have something that'll be the equivalent of multiple life sentences. But you notice there's no hate crimes charged. I mean, there was a lot of, I think, pretty powerful suggestion that this was a race-based incident. He had violent rap lyrics. He had social media postings about F Donald Trump and F the pigs and things of that nature. And I don't always gravitate towards hate crimes. I think it can be overplayed. If you have a horrible motive for your murders, you know, murder is a serious charge. But it's interesting in this case that, of all cases, that we never hear a word from the attorney general. We don't see the backup federal charges like he did in George Floyd's case, Breonna Taylor's, Mr. Arbery down in Georgia. There's been a variety of cases where he's very quick to file additional federal civil rights charges based on hateful murders. And for some reason, it's the stony silence when it comes to Daryl Brooks. So, again, hopefully the state system's going to work just fine. He's going to get a significant sentence. I don't think we should abandon federalism. But there is a real inconsistency in the DOJ approach to something like the Daryl Brooks massacre compared to some of these other cases.
You're a former federal prosecutor, and you've seen your share of drug cases. What is your reaction to the Biden pardoning of marijuana cases?
Yeah, I have a pretty cranky, bad reaction to that one, Rick. And it's not that I have some big problem with possession of marijuana. I think this is a political stunt. It's a mass pardon that will affect, to some degree, maybe about 7,000 U.S. citizens and maybe another 1,000 illegal aliens or sometimes lawful permanent residents. But the devil's always in the details in these things. You know, there's a number of these people are going to get pardons for their possession of marijuana count, but they were still convicted of other charges. And most likely those other charges are the ones that carried the significant weight of jail time or severe penalties. So there's a whole bunch of these that are going to be symbolic at best. But it's all built upon a myth. You know, when I was a federal prosecutor, I can't say I know every single office around the country, but you get to know a lot of U.S. attorneys. You get to know the charging philosophies. And these prosecutors were not wasting their time on street-level drug addicts or people that were smoking a joint. I mean, that's just not what federal drug prosecutions normally were. I had drug cases where they were talking about landing strips in Bolivia and putting kilograms of heroin and cocaine into car batteries to smuggle them across the border with mules driving rental cars. I mean, sophisticated, you know, wiretap, multi-defendant, multi-state or even multi-country international cases. They're not wasting their time on the kid on the street corner smoking a joint. And even if they did, the judges aren't taking those misdemeanor cases and putting people in jail. So, you know, this is, I think, addressing an issue that's not an issue, that there's not really many federal marijuana possession cases. It's a feel-good moment for President Biden, I suppose, to say, look how progressive I'm being. But it's just not the type of thing that means anything to the actual ebb and flow of criminal prosecution in federal court.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington, thank you for the updates, and we'll see you next weekend.
Sure thing. Have a good weekend.
And you can follow Jim on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. The 7 o'clock news coming up next on WMAL.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9. WMAL.